And the Oscar goes to?
No, the Oscar goes to...
Sorry.
It's okay. I'm so happy to give you this again, Clint. $1 million baby!
People die every day, Frankie. Mopping floors, washing dishes. And you know what their last thought is? I never got my shot. Because of you, Maggie got her shot. If she dies today, you know what her last thought would be? I think I did all right.
Hello to all our listeners out there. I'm your host, Luke Shoemaker.
And I'm your other host, Zach King.
And this is And the Award Goes To, a podcast that breaks down in great depth each Best Picture winner from this century, one film at a time. Along the way, you will hear the competition and who Zach and I believe should have won for each year. Last time, Zach and I traveled across Middle Earth all the way to Mount Doom with The Return of the King. This time, we are going round by round with Million Dollar Baby. This is, you know, this is a boxing movie, but so much more to it than that. But I am curious, what is your favorite boxing movie of all time?
That's a tough question. So I'm going to go a little bit outside the box and a little more recent with The Fighter, David O. Russell's film, Mark Wahlberg, Christian Bale. I'm just a big, big fan of that movie. So my top three would probably look like that, this film, Million Dollar Baby, and then Cinderella Man, which we've talked about previously, we're big fans of. And, you know, I do love Rocky and the new Creed franchise. Being a Michael B. Jordan fan, nothing against those. And, you know, Rocky, shout out to Rocky. It did win Best Picture back in the day. But it's just not in the same league, in my opinion, as the three I just mentioned.
Notice there for our listeners, Zach hates Raging Bull.
We haven't even... Come on now. You're going to drop that bomb on them already.
I'm trying to wake them up and get them, you know, I just want them on my side.
I get it. I don't hate it for the record, but it's not my favorite Scorsese, but you know, we'll get there.
For sure. Give us your opening thoughts on Million Dollar Baby.
Absolutely. Million Dollar Baby. Wow. I don't think, you know, I've ever been so devastated by a film upon first watch and rewatch than Million Dollar Baby. You know, I put this film up there as far as like the saddest I've ever seen, with One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Brokeback Mountain, The Pianist, which we've talked about, and then, you know, The Green Mile, we've also talked about, all just incredibly sad films. And this is right there with it. And, you know, I'm not going to say Manchester just because, to me, there's enough humor in that film that kind of distracts from the grief, and in a brilliant way, by the way. So, you know, with this movie, you get three devastatingly brilliant performances by Swank, Eastwood, and Morgan Freeman. And, you know, in a story that just really bores into your soul, you know, because, you know, Maggie, she came from nothing, essentially, and she had a dream that many would say is next to impossible, including Frankie told her that. But, you know, just through a relationship with these two strong but tortured souls, she reached her dream with, you know, ultimately tragic consequences. And it's a movie that stays with you long after the screen fades to black. And I'm just thankful for the gifts to cinema that Clint Eastwood and Morgan Freeman can put on full display in this film at such an older age. And I do love this movie because, even though it is a boxing movie on the surface, it's just so much more than that. And it really grabs you emotionally and never lets go.
14, 30, doesn't really matter. When Frankie clicks that button and pulls her ventilator, that's devastating. I mean, most boxing movies usually end with the champ being lifted up, you know, and there's some kind of happy ending and everyone's celebrating, but this is crippling. I, like you, see it up there with movies that you mentioned, like Frankie Dunn and Lee Chandler from Manchester, two of the most broken characters in all of cinema, essentially no redemption for their lives after their big losses. And it's a movie, you know, we've discussed a lot of movies on this pod, but this one really gets dominated by basically just three characters, and all three characters on another level. Morgan Freeman's narrations, Eastwood's presence on multiple levels, and of course, Miss Hilary Swank. Like, on rewatch, I felt an even deeper connection to it, because after being a coach for almost a decade, you hope and you pray that you can mentor, love, and ultimately protect those that you lead. And the way Frankie cares for Maggie, of course, it's in his own unique way how he shows love. It's just a beautiful film. And even through all of the saddening parts, it's terrific. And now let's get into attention to details. We discuss director, cast, writers, cinematographer, box office numbers, nominations and wins, and just its overall historical perspective. 7 nominations, but not the most that year, right?
So, no, Aviator led the way with 11 nominations, a film I'm going to talk about later. And Aviator also picked up 5 wins. Million Dollar Baby comes away with 4. Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actress, and then Best Supporting Actor. So, and then the other nominations for that year were Best Actor, Best Adapted Screenplay, and Best Film Editing. So, you know, not the most, obviously, but a solid 2 out of the big 5, 3 out of the big 5, actually. So, you know, respectable.
Yeah, it's a pretty good haul. You know, we discussed not on air, but we discussed how it was really heavily marketed as a boxing movie, but it didn't give away that it was going to be that dark. But I guess when you're going to advertise something, you show boxing and you show a Clint Eastwood boxing movie and you show a female champ and it's like, oh yeah, let's go watch this because of that. Interesting on how quickly it moved to release. It was released on December 15th of 2004, limited release, but didn't actually get shown to most of the public till January 28th of 2005. What was the rationale behind all of that?
They released it only for the critics 1 week before the 15th, and then, you know, straight into awards season on the 15th. So that's really interesting. They only screened it for the critics, did not test screen it at all for any audiences, obviously, because they didn't want, you know, the third act to get out, and, you know, the big gut punch of the film, per se, to get out. So, you know, recency bias may be in play here, especially it being such an emotionally devastating film and playing it that late. It probably stayed on the hearts and minds of voters.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, coming off Mystic River, they already kind of were pretty high on Eastwood. And now it's like, oh, wow, this is powerful.
Yeah. And yeah, Mystic River, you know, being, you've talked about it, such a powerful film as well, and this just tops it, per se, which is crazy. Let's get into their box office numbers, though. This is interesting, Luke. So it made how much?
It made $100 million domestically, which for movies released in that year, that only ranks 24th. It makes $216 million worldwide, but an $18 million budget. That blows my mind.
Much in Clint Eastwood fashion, a budget coming in at or below $30 million. He is notorious for that. So, I mean, they made their money back. It's just, I can kind of see why it didn't make more money, it being so, you know, such a tough third act and emotional film to chew on. But yeah, that's the master Clint Eastwood working the budget always, which... Let's get right into it. Our director, Clint Eastwood. So, Luke, did you know he is the oldest winner for Best Director at the Oscars at the age of 74? That stands to this day. Incredible. He's an 11-time Oscar nominee, 4 as a director, twice for Best Actor, and has 2 Best Picture wins and 2 Best Director wins for this and Unforgiven, a Western which you really admire. So he's in that elite club of Steven Spielberg, Oliver Stone, Alejandro Iñárritu, Alfonso Cuarón, and Ang Lee, all having 2 Best Director Oscars. And, you know, his other movies he received nominations for, Mystic River, Letters from Iwo Jima, and American Sniper, great, great films as well, quality at work. So, you know, just an absolute legend, both as an actor and as a director. And I think he gives maybe the best performance of his career in this film. You know, he's just that perfect blend of hard as nails, tough guy matched with that, you know, that inner soft heart you see come out for the vulnerable and the afraid. And I love the films I mentioned above, and along with Gran Torino. That's just such a great performance by him at an older age. Like, he is with Frankie Dunn. And, you know, his Man with No Name Western films are classics. Those are going to live on forever. As a fan of Westerns, you know, I love them. And Unforgiven, obviously, too, winning Best Picture. And I find it remarkable. He just had an Oscar nominated film this past year for Richard Jewell at the age of 89. With no plans to retire. I'm not sure what his next project is, but I'm excited to see it. And, you know, I should have mentioned him among our top actors over the age of 75, even though he doesn't really act anymore, because he's just that much of a legendary talent. And I don't think there's a better director actor combo, which is saying something, because there's been some top notch ones in this industry, in the history of film. And what I love about Clint is how he works. He's, you know, he's known for those quick production times and shooting schedules. He normally shoots under 60 days, normally 40 days max, which is fast, efficient. And, you know, released this movie in December. He had shot it in September and already had it edited and ready for awards season. That's incredible. Oh, yeah, and he's used the same editor for all of his films, used, you know, a lot of the same crew. I think you've talked about he used the Mystic River crew for this. So he did the same turnaround at Richard Jewell just recently at 89. And this is simply because it's interesting. He doesn't do a lot of takes, you know, and we talked about actors. A lot of actors love this. You know, certain actors don't mind. You can do take after take. And he never yells action either, because he just prefers to always have his actors the most comfortable coming from that world. And what I love about him is his innate ability to perfectly cast his roles. Kevin Bacon, Sean Penn, and then Tim Robbins. Those were his first three choices for Mystic River. You know, that's just an innate feel for casting. And I think that's much like Scorsese and Spike Lee do. He perfectly casts his films. But, you know, the difference being, unlike Fincher, the late great Stanley Kubrick, he only needs 2 to 3 takes for a scene, while they like hundreds sometime. So what do you think of our boy Clint?
Yeah, when we get into casting cut, we'll touch on kind of what you talked about with his ability to choose. Yeah, 2 to 3 scenes. You know, Fincher's one of my favorites, but he is, you know, 100 take plus kind of guy. Everything I read and hear about Clint Eastwood, he's quite the perfectionist, but he's quite the planner. And you obviously have to be quite the planner to shoot movies that quickly. And I think the greats in any field always are perfectionists, or they're quite great at planning out in great detail how they're going to attack something. I grew up watching Dirty Harry, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, Escape from Alcatraz, and just all of his classics on AMC and Turner Classic Movies. You hear all the Chuck Norris jokes in your lifetime, but this guy, he's the tough guy. Like, I don't care how anyone out there feels about his political stances. Admire him for his talent. Enjoy whatever Eastwood we still get. He just turned 90. It's remarkable that he's still producing content. I don't think anyone has ever been able to do both acting and directing as well as he has for as long as he has done it. Like, you look at sports, many of the great athletes fell as coaches or GMs or, you know, even owners. Just shout out to Michael Jordan. You know, it's just really hard to succeed in both as well as he has. He's a marvel. So that being said, give us your top talents who are actually successful in both areas.
Mel Gibson and Kevin Costner are two who have won Oscars as well for films that they've directed and starred in. And I really admire both of those men a great deal. I think they're fantastic in front of the camera as well as behind it. The great Denzel Washington has actually directed 3 films as well, Fences being his latest, and he was outstanding in that. And then as for the legends, you got to mention Charlie Chaplin as, you know, the original actor turned director, just the best. And then younger actors doing it right now, I'm going to rattle off a few who I really admire behind the camera. Ben Affleck, Greta Gerwig, Joel Edgerton, Bradley Cooper, Jason Bateman, Ben Stiller, and Olivia Wilde. So if you haven't seen any of their films, highly encourage you to do so. They're very talented directors as well as actors and actresses.
Get into our writer, Paul Haggis, 5-time nominee, 3 straight nominations for screenplay. Incredible 3 years. That's I think you and I, through the research we dug through, we don't believe that's ever happened, correct?
Pretty sure it's an unprecedented run in Oscar history, yes.
Yeah, he gets this, Crash, and Letters from Iwo Jima. He wins two Oscars. The next year in our next pod, when we get into Crash for Best Original Screenplay and Best Picture, he also gets a nom for directing. But he, like some of the people we run into in Hollywood, he has a controversial past.
Yeah, which we'll get into on the next pod. It is interesting, though, with this film, you know, the research we've done, it was stuck in, you know, that development hell, the industry term they talk about for many years, with a lot of studios rejecting it just because it's such a, you know, a downer, and Warner Brothers wouldn't take it up, and Clint Eastwood, you know, being Clint Eastwood, was able to get the funding and put up half the budget with a friend of his, and, you know, he basically said, yeah, I know it's a downer, but it's gorgeous, and I can make it. And obviously Warner Brothers has that long-standing relationship with Clint Eastwood, and I think you and I can agree that's one of our favorite studios because they have the relationship with Clint Eastwood and Christopher Nolan. Just they pair with great directors and they let them make all their films. And that's a beautiful thing when you have a studio that will do that with an actual talented director with something to say. So, you know, always interesting to see how production finally starts.
Yeah, it takes a lot of things going right. Speaking of getting things right, cinematographer, who else but the same man that works with Eastwood from 2003 all the way up to 2018? That's 14 movies in total. Tom Stern, but only one nomination in his career for the movie Changeling. Interesting that he only has the one nomination, but he obviously has to be talented for Eastwood to keep bringing him back.
He's great on this film. I thought he should have been nominated for Mystic River. I thought how they shot Boston was, you know, pretty exceptional. And then if you've seen the Iwo Jima films, he does great on that. He does great, pretty good on American Sniper, minus the fake baby, which, you know, if you read what happened there, they didn't have a choice. The kids didn't show up for filming that day. So I think he's kind of gotten up there in years like Eastwood, because he hasn't been his DP since 15-17 to Paris, so his last like three films. But definitely a talented guy. It's a shame the Academy hasn't recognized him more.
We're gonna get into cast. You got Clint Eastwood.
So I think we've said about everything we can about this man, you know, as a director and as an actor. He is a two-time nominee as an actor for this film and Unforgiven in the Best Actor category. So I just want to ask you, what is your favorite Clint Eastwood role and what is your favorite film that he's directed? And I realize that could be the same, given that he does both.
For acting, give me Fistful of Dollars or Unforgiven. But for directing, give me the Arkansas, baby. Give me Bridges of Madison. I'm kidding. I love Gran Torino. Possibly my favorite acting-directing combo of his, right up there with this and Unforgiven. But if I had to choose one film where I have to have him as actor and director, I might choose Gran Torino. I don't know. I just really love that movie.
It's a great film. I do have a hot take here about Clint and Westerns. I love Westerns. I grew up watching every John Wayne Western ever, as long as various others. And I'm not the biggest fan of Unforgiven. Granted, I do love the end when he finally confronts little Bill Daggett or whatever, Gene Hackman's character, in that saloon and just takes them all out. It's the best.
It needed to happen.
Well, it's such a dark film, you know, is what threw me off for a Western. Very dark, but yeah, that's the icing on the cake. So this leads me to our leading lady, Hilary Swank. She's a two-time nominee with wins for Best Actress both times she was nominated. So she's in that elite club, like Renee Zellweger, Kate Blanchett, with two Oscars. And she said in her acceptance speech that she grew up in a trailer park. And she took this role, obviously, because she related to Maggie's background, and doing some research on her, that is accurate. She comes from very humble beginnings. And unlike Maggie, though, she has a close relationship with her mother, who she credits for a lot of her success. You know, I really think she is a fantastic actress. And I think she's given many great performances over the year. Obviously, as a teacher, my favorite film of hers is Freedom Riders. I think she gives one of her best performances, though, in this film. You know, it's heartbreaking in every sense of the word. Who doesn't want to root for Maggie Fitzgerald? And that just makes me want to ask you, though, who do you think is a better actress, Hilary Swank or Renee Zellweger? With, you know, they both have two Oscars.
Oh, this is tough. Our listeners know my feelings all too well on Zell, but if you just take their career in total and compare the films they have done, Zell has been able to sustain a longer, more noteworthy career. Tell me the last time you went to a movie or you pull up a movie on any of the streaming services that Swank was in, had a leading role. I mean, is it Freedom Riders? And that was
Freedom
what,
Riders
2007, eight.
Yeah. It's like 07, 08.
So it's about over a decade there, you know. She's in Logan Lucky, which is a movie I enjoy, but you could cut her character. No one would notice. She does have the two Oscars. I think she has the two better Oscars than Zell.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is certainly better than Judy that you've discussed. But I think for sustainability, you have to go with Zellweger because people are still at studios are still like, we can use her. And no one's really saying that about our girl Swank.
Sad but true.
It's just, it's weird. It's very weird to me of how she's kind of fallen off the map. A guy who has been another legend on screen, I have Morgan Freeman. It's our boy Scrap in this movie. 5-time nominee for Street Smart, Driving Mrs. Daisy, Shawshank, which is one of my favorites, this movie, and Invictus. His only film in his career, you know, his only award in his career came from this film, and it's in a supporting role. You know, he loses to Hanks, Daniel Day-Lewis, and Jeff Bridges in some of his roles as a leading man, and those are all tough losses. He's one of those actors, when he finally passes, and let me preface this by saying that all death is tragic, but I'll feel a lot of sadness. I will feel sadness that one of my favorite voices in all of Hollywood has left us. There's just something so soothing, so calming, yet sometimes so chilling. I'm getting goosebumps just thinking of him narrating things. Like, the ending to Shawshank still gives me goosebumps. He's absolute icon to the film industry, and I've enjoyed most of his films on like a grand scale. You know, lately he's kind of fallen into some duds, and he just picks up roles, and, you know, he does... Olympus Has Fallen and movies like that, but he's still a legend. He has so many classics. He has 126 acting credits to his name. So I pose this question: your top five Morgan Freeman roles, go.
Have to be this film, Shawshank, Seven, Glory. I love him in Glory with Denzel. And then I really like him as Alex Cross in Kiss the Girls with Ashley Judd. Just a really cool serial killer murder mystery film. And in my opinion, he's the best narrator ever for any film. Any film you would want him to narrate, he would be the best person to pick. I love his voice. And I kind of wish he'd won for Shawshank, honestly, since Hanks had won the previous year. But, you know, who's going to take two Oscars away from Tom Hanks, which I'm not. So
no, we'll get into some other notables or names you out there may just recognize. Give us our first one.
Jay Baruchel. Most of you may know him, very funny comedic leading man from Canada. You know, this might be the best performance of his career though. You know, since he's only done comedies pretty much since this, which he's also good in, but I love him as Danger in this film. He's just one of those another heartbreaking characters that you can empathize with.
Yeah, he's always fit like the Michael Cera lovable geek role. And, you know, he does a great job of portraying that character with a big heart. And maybe that's because in real life he is that way. I don't know, but he's very likable, very easy to empathize with on the screen. And like you, like, he has a minor role in this, but it may be some of his best acting he's ever done.
So good in this. But this leads us to another heavyweight, Anthony Mackie. Wow, talk about a big time talent and someone me and you both just really admire. you know, I loved him in The Hurt Locker. That's when he really blew me away, and I noticed him. And also his brief turn as Tupac in Notorious. He was really good in that. He's an MCU guy, you know, who we talked about. He's great in his role. It's perfect casting for that franchise. You know, he's really picked up that mantle and ran with it. I love his character in it.
Yeah, Hurt Locker for me was his like really big coming out. I enjoy him in this. I enjoy him in We Are Marshall. But yeah, give me the Falcon. I just recently rewatched Winter Soldier, where he first entered the MCU, and I love him in it. And like obviously Disney loves him because all the films he did with them, he's in the upcoming Falcon and Winter Soldier series, which apparently they are looking into the possibility of doing two seasons of that. So they may even change the title of the series. He's going to become the first Black Captain America on screen. So that's a huge shout out to him and the trust they have in his abilities. He's just fun. He's just good on screen. I enjoy him. And shout out to him in 8 Mile.
Yeah, that's right. He's Papa Doc in 8 Mile, the villain, essentially.
Yeah.
The thing about Anthony Mackie, and he's going to be like this next guy we talk about, perfect blend of tough guy with just devastating humor. So funny. Can be just hilarious at any time. Why don't you tell us, though, about Michael Pena?
Michael Pena. I love this guy. If they ever do Shea Serrano on screen about his story, Pena's the guy. And he's been in 5 different films that have either won or been nominated for Best Picture. And, you know, he's great in all of them. Like, he's great in Fury. He's great in The Martian. He's great in Cesar Chavez. We're going to get really heavy into him on the next pod. But his comedic relief in the MCU is some of the most enjoyable moments. It's probably the best part of Ant-Man and Ant-Man and the Wasp. Luis rambling about a different story that should take about 3 hours, and he tells it in about 30 seconds, is some of the best parts of those movies. What are your thoughts on him?
I love him. I think he's, like Mackie, just such a big-time talent. And you see that being cast in 5 movies that were Best Picture noms or winners. And then Narcos Mexico, he's fantastic in season 1 of that. He's devastating in End of Watch. And then a supporting role I just crack up every time is him in American Hustle playing the Arab Sheik. He's hilarious. Another great David O. Russell movie.
Just knows essentially nothing about the Arab language.
But it's just furious how they're treating the case. It's great. Very talented actor.
We're going to transition into IMDb versus Rotten Tomato scores. We talk about, are we over or are we under in regards to the score? So IMDb rolls in at 8.1. The tomato meter rolls in at a 91. In one of our first movies where the audience score almost nails the tomato meter, the audience score at 90. Where are you at?
Make them all a 95 and I'm good, because there's not really a flaw in this movie. We'll talk about it, and it's not much of one because it's just an emotional thing, but this movie's perfect from beginning to end.
Yeah, I'm definitely over on all of them. IMDb, give me like a 9.4. Tomato meter, yeah, I'm above the 91. Like you said, 95, 96. There's a lot of movies that end up in the mid-90s that I don't think are as good as this movie. So definitely over. Next section of our podcast is where we get into Sell It to My Dad. So for our listeners, my dad has not seen a lot of movies. So Zach, sell this movie to my dad.
Marty, I know you can appreciate a good boxing movie, you know, like Rocky. Take this movie as the female version of Rocky, and I really think you're going to like it. Just put that in your mind, female version of Rocky. You're going to love it. It takes you on that wild ride, you know, with the champ, and you rise from rags to riches with them. Takes a little different turn than Rocky, which is, you know, going to leave you in a different place, but it's worth taking that journey watching. If you want to watch, honestly, a Clint Eastwood film where he acts in it, he's great. And then it's a boxing movie and one of the best you'll ever watch. So check out Million Dollar Baby, Marty.
Yeah, and it's got Clint Eastwood, Morgan Freeman, Dad. You'll get a kick out of it. We're going into our rundown. So give us our plot synopsis rundown, ladies and gentlemen. Heavy spoiler alert.
So the film opens with the classic Clint Eastwood black and white Warner Brothers logo. He uses that backdrop every time with his own musical composition to open many of his films, just like this one. So there's a great guitar melody to open this film as we hear a crowd cheering, and we open on a packed boxing gym with a fighter just getting pummeled against the ropes. Then the bell rings, and as the fighter that was getting pummeled enters his corner, Morgan Freeman's narration comes over with the opening lines of the film. "I only ever met one man I wouldn't want to fight." And we meet Frankie Dunn, who Freeman says was the best cut man in the business when he met him. And he started training and managing fighters in the 60s, and he hasn't lost his touch since. Dunn works hard to close up a cut below the eye on his fighter, Willie. He convinces the doctor to let the fight go on, who gives him one more round. And then he instructs Willie to let him hit you to seal the cut on the wound. What do you think of this opening scene, Luke, as far as just a tone setter? We love to talk about openings to films.
I mean, it goes right into it. Like, it goes right into, you know, some action with the brutality of what is, you know, boxing at times. And, you know, that draws you in. Freeman discussing over the fight, you know, some of the different intricacies of boxing. That draws you in because you're like, oh, yeah, there's Morgan Freeman's voice, you know. Eastwood actually just kind of looks like he is a corner man. Like, maybe he does that as a side job. And then you see Swank appearing from that tunnel, and you've got all three immediately introduced, immediately know the tone of this movie as far as that boxing side and who the main players are, and you're ready to dive right in.
Yep, so the round starts, you know. The other fighter lands the blow on the cut that Frankie told him to drop his hand, and it seals the wound. And then Willie quickly goes to work on the other fighter. Like you said, Swank emerges from the shadows of the tunnel watching the fight, and Frankie has a big smile on his face as Willie knocks out his competition. We cut to Frankie emerging from the locker room, and Swank's character introduces herself as Maggie Fitzgerald and says she won her fight on the undercard. She asks Frankie to train and manage her, which he roughly declines. What were his words?
To say the least, man, it probably hasn't aged well, but he is just, he's not going to train a female. It's pretty blunt, kind of shows his character off on full display of how rough he is around the edges. But I just love her, like, grit and kind of fearlessness, because she doesn't really care that he's been a jerk. Girly.
Doesn't intimidate her at all. So we cut to the parking lot. Frankie's telling Willie they were offered a title shot, but he turned it down. He says two or three more fights and Willie's going to be ready. We see Frankie praying in the next scene beside bedside, asking for protection for himself and someone named Katie. The next scene, Frankie leaves church and he tells the priest the sermon made him weep sarcastically, and he starts bantering with him to the point that the priest curses at him. He asks Frankie, though, if he has written his daughter. First mention of that. What do you think of Frankie's relationship with his priest here, Luke?
Man, Eastwood and priests in movies, interesting combo. How he baits this priest, we'll talk about it in our favorite quotes, maybe even favorite scenes. It's just, it's one of the funniest parts of the movie, but you also kind of see that he has a very devout faith, because I mean, the priest brings up that he's there every week.
As a daughter, we learn about, apparently. So we cut to the outside the Hit Pit gym. So this is Frankie's gym that he owns. And we meet inside Danger Dillard, a skinny young man with a lot of heart, Jay Baruchel's character. And then we meet our narrator, Scrap, Morgan Freeman, who Danger says doesn't have anything against because he's black, which in a more rude way. Danger wants to fight for a world championship and is antagonized by Sherelle, a larger, more experienced fighter, which is Anthony Mackie's character. And Scrap defends Danger, showing his paternal nature. He tells via voiceover that Frankie bought the gym 17 years ago and found out afterward most gyms lose money. Frankie banters with Scrap, much like the priest, showing their close bond, one of the few that Frankie has. Willie comes in to train and is seen by Scrap talking to another well-known manager. Frankie practices Gaelic back in his office until Scrap warns him that Willie is talking to a big-time manager named Mickey Mack. Scrap then points out Maggie hitting the heavy bag in the gym, much to Frankie's dismay. Frankie leaves his office to tell Maggie that she's wasting her time and he won't train her. Scrap narrates that Maggie came from a white trash family in Southwest Missouri. We see a cutscene of Maggie as a waitress saving a leftover steak a customer left. She's then in a dimly lit apartment eating and counting her tips. What did you think of kind of getting this first introduction of who Maggie's character is, you know, where she's from and her life outside of the gym?
Man, it definitely shows her drive and motivation. And it definitely, we talk about having sympathy for a character or really, you know, backing a character and her. I mean, obviously she's dirt poor, but she's fighting and she's doing all that she can to try to pursue a dream that many would probably tell her that she's foolish to pursue, but she doesn't care. And you have to rally behind that. You also have to love, you know, the dynamic between Scrap and Frankie when they banter. It all is great stuff. And we're not even 30 minutes into the movie.
Right. Such a solid opening. So then we cut back to Maggie. She's back in the gym, hitting the heavy bag the very next day. Frankie tells Scrap to give her money back in his office, but she paid 6 months in advance. So we cut to Scrap cleaning up the gym at the end of a long day, but Maggie is still inside hitting the heavy bag. Scrap gives her a lesson on how to properly hit the heavy bag. He tells her he will put her on a speed bag next, which Maggie doesn't have, but Scrap lends her. He shows her his room in the gym and that the fact that he lives there. Maggie comments that it's nice and continues to work out into the night over a gorgeous piano composition by Clint Eastwood himself and narration by Freeman. We cut to Frankie working out with Willie the next day as Maggie arrives. Sherelle notices Maggie for the first time and starts making fun of her, telling Danger to fight her. Maggie cuts Sherelle down, though, with a hilarious joke about his last fight after he makes fun of her figure. Danger gets in on the joke, further angering Sherelle, and just a hilarious scene. Frankie tells Willie that he'll help him get his wife her old car back after Willie complains after their training session. And then Scrap mentions to Frankie that Maggie is coming along, and Frankie realizes that Scrap has been helping her and has given her the speed bag from his gym. He promptly goes over to her and asks for it back. And then Frankie tells Maggie that she's too old to be a fighter and that it takes 4 years to train, and her being 31 is not feasible. He gives Maggie the speed bag back, though, out of pity. In the next scene, Frankie is visited by Willie at his home, who tells him he's leaving him for Mickey Mack and a shot at the title. Willie thanks Frankie for teaching him everything he needed to know in a pretty heartbreaking scene. Scrap visits with Frankie back in the gym the next day, telling him basically that he blew his chance at a title shot because he doesn't believe in his fighters. Frankie chastises Scrap for losing his eye to boxing despite being a better fighter than Willie ever was, which I really thought was a revealing scene about Scrap, you know, learning more about who he was in his previous life and just the quality of fighter that he was. Just a great scene. So we cut to a montage of scenes of Maggie working as a waitress, getting up early to run on the beach, working out in Frankie's gym, and then finally buying her own speed bag. And then we cut to Frankie watching Willie's title fight some months later at his house, and Willie wins handily, knocking out his opponent. Frankie shows up after the fight at the gym that night and brings Scrap a cheeseburger. Frankie hears Maggie working on the speed bag and that it's her 32nd birthday. Maggie tells Frankie she's been waitressing since she was 13 and that her family is essentially white trash and that boxing is all that makes her feel good. Frankie agrees to train Maggie after her impassioned speech, but not be her manager. He starts to teach Maggie how to properly hit the speed bag in another montage. What did you think of that scene there? From learning more about Maggie and where she's from directly from her, and just how upset she gets, you know, with his constant, you know, giving her crap for her dream, and then him finally being like, all right, that I got your back.
It's quite remarkable. I can't think of, you know, in my lifetime when I've wanted to follow a dream or a passion, I haven't had is what apparently looks in her life is as much suffering. And that gives you chills to think about how much she wants this. And I think ultimately for a guy that's as tough around, rough around the edges as Frankie, I think he finally sees that. Like if she is this devoted, and this, you know, has this much passion in it, you can throw out all the other variables about her being too old, because sometimes just your drive alone can make you successful. And I think ultimately he decides, all right, I'll do this for you because, I mean, how can I not, right?
Absolutely. No other option at that point. So we get another fantastic montage of Maggie training in the gym, but now with Frankie as her trainer, and then she's even waitressing on the side. As the montage plays out, Maggie appears stronger and more skilled as a fighter. She asks Frankie after a sparring session if she's ready for a fight, which he dodges. And then she asks Frankie if he has a family, which he admits that he has a daughter, but they're not close. And Frankie connects Maggie with the manager, Sally, for her first fight. We cut from there to Maggie's first fight, in which she's losing, but Sally urges her to keep on and tells her she's doing great. Scrap and Frankie watch the fight from the balcony in dismay until Frankie decides to intervene and he can't take it anymore. With Frankie's instructions, Maggie knocks out her opponent, and then, you know, they celebrate in joy. Scrap compares her to Sugar Ray. Back in the locker room, Frankie tells Maggie to protect herself at all times. It's the number one rule. He tells Maggie that he will never leave her again, and just a really touching scene. What did you think of that, of Frankie just being so pissed he finally went down there and said, I've had it?
It's wild. It's really wild. I don't know the rules of boxing in regards to that, mm-hmm. but it's comparable that if someone just came down to the sideline while I'm coaching one night and said, I got it, I can get out of here, I got it, and just took over, and then the team won. Like, it's wild in terms of sport, but it also shows that this has weighed heavily on his heart, and now that he's all in. And I like the Sugar Ray part that you brought up, because if Scrap, who apparently was such a great fighter, sees the potential in her, maybe the sky's the limit.
It'd be like Bobby Knight coming down from the stands at Indiana and coaching a game, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. It's probably very similar as far as character between the two. But, yeah, imagine Bob Knight coming down there. Or, like, you know, if Bill Belichick retires someday, he may come out of the stands at Foxborough and try to coach the game.
Yeah, I can see it. Okay, so the next day, Maggie's back in the gym working out against Frankie's advice. He told her to take 3 days off, but she's already back, and Frankie's pleased by this. We see another great montage of scenes with Maggie winning fight after fight via first-round knockout. In the locker room, though, Frankie scolds Maggie for knocking out her opponents too soon, saying no fighter, you know, wants to be embarrassed, but she questions him on why she's fighting in four-round fights. So Frankie makes Maggie fight one more four-rounder, which she wins via KO, but just to prove a point. And we cut to her first six-round fight, in which Maggie knocks out her opponent at the end of the first round. Some brilliant narration by Scrap, building the suspense. Then we get another great montage of Frankie paying other managers so they'll agree to fight Maggie, which doesn't work for long. So Frankie takes a chance and moves Maggie up in weight class. We cut to her first fight in the new weight class, and Maggie's doing well until her nose is broken. Frankie fixes it in a gruesome scene that allows Maggie to keep fighting, and she quickly knocks out her opponent with his instructions. Frankie and Scrap take Maggie to the hospital, where she's reminded to always protect herself again. Maggie knocks out her next two opponents, raising her to 12-0. She gets two offers to fight title holders, but Frankie turns them both down. Scrap takes Maggie out to dinner in a very touching scene and sets up a meeting with Mickey Mack for her there. Scrap tells Maggie the story of how he lost his eye in his last fight with Frankie as his cut man. Scrap alludes to Frankie blaming himself for him losing his eye. Maggie tells Mickey, though, after Scrap leaves, that she will never leave Frankie Dunn. Really touching scene, and I enjoyed finally, you know, hearing the story of how Scrap actually lost his eye, and we get the connection there, too, between him and Frankie. It's pretty wild and heartbreaking at the same time.
It's great. You know, we talked about on Gladiator, Maximus got told the same thing about stop killing people so fast. It's like, can you imagine coaching someone who's so good, you have to tell them to not win so quickly?
Yeah, you're embarrassing the competition. Stop. That's you're too good.
Just insane. I'm sure
Zion in high school probably got that speech, but anyway. Yeah,
quit dunking it every time.
Yeah. So we see Frankie at home with several returned letters as he opens the store, confirming that he does write to his daughter every week, like he tells the priest. And a pretty heartbreaking admission. Frankie visits Maggie at a rundown apartment and urges her to buy herself a house. He tells her she's going to fight the British champ next, which, you know, she's overjoyed. We cut to London, where Maggie is fighting the British champ. Frankie gifts Maggie with her fighting robe with a Gaelic saying on it. Maggie knocks her out in the second round, and Scrap narrates that Maggie started to fight all over Europe with her Gaelic name, Mokushla. Maggie returns to the States, the nickname sticking, and wins her first fight and gets a second offer for the title fight against a dirty former prostitute boxing German nicknamed the Blue Bear. Maggie tells Frankie she bought a house like she told him to, which, you know, he's proud of her. So they go to Missouri to see Maggie's family, and she shows them the house she bought for her mother and family. Her mother is less than thankful, worrying it will endanger her welfare check, and says she should have just gave her the money. Frankie looks on at her mother and sister in disgust, and Maggie's mother tells her everyone laughs at her for being a boxer, and then she laughs at her rudely in her face, too. What do you think of finally meeting Maggie's family there in Missouri? Oh,
man. She sucks. She sucks so bad that I ran Google searches for who are the worst, parents in all of film. And it started giving me some good comparables here. I mean, you could go to the MCU, Thanos, terrible dad, but in a more practical sense, the dad from Dead Poets Society, literally leads to his son committing suicide, how about the mom from Gone Baby Gone?
Oh, like, God.
She's right up there with some of the worst individuals you're ever going to meet in any movie. She's just so tough of a watch. It's like, let's go ahead. It's the other one I thought was really interesting is I, Tonya. Like, no wonder she is willing to live in a little bitty 4x4 apartment and grind it out as a waitress, anything to get the heck away from them.
Exactly. So on the drive back, Maggie tells Frankie about her terminally ill father having to put down the family dog back in the day. She tells Frankie that he's all that she has. And Frankie finalizes the title fight for Maggie and asks Scrap if he wants to come to Vegas with him, which Scrap declines. Frankie asks Maggie if she would rather fly or drive to Vegas, which Maggie decides to fly there and drive back. Back at the gym, Sherelle caused the toilet to overflow as a distraction for Scrap to fight Danger. Once Scrap realizes the ruse, he rescues a beaten Danger. Sherelle continues to taunt Danger and Scrap, which makes Scrap put on just one of Danger's gloves and proceed to knock out Sherelle. What did you think of this scene? Because, oh, man, I loved it. I'd been waiting for it all movie.
Like, man, dude, if I can't imagine a time in a movie where I wanted someone to get hit in the face more. I mean, I'm sure after saying this, I'll reflect and go, oh, maybe this guy. But when he gets the glove on the hand and just drops him, that's great stuff, and it needed to be done. I don't know if any of this was in the short story, but I'm glad it's in this story because it really just makes you love Scrap even that much more.
Sometimes a bully's just got to get knocked out. So Maggie enters the ring for her title fight to Bagpipes and Chants of Mokushla. As the fight gets underway, Maggie proves she belongs by taking it to the aggressive and dirty fighting Blue Bear. The Blue Bear uses dirty tactics throughout the round, including hitting Maggie with an elbow while the ref's back is turned. The next round, Maggie quickly drops the champ with Frankie's advice and wins the round handedly. The round after that, Maggie takes it to the Bear, beating her badly, but as the bell rings and Maggie walks to her corner, she is hit with a cheap shot that causes her to fall neck first on her ringside stool. Maggie lays lifeless, not moving, as the scene fades to black. We see Maggie in a hospital bed with a ventilator attached. She awakens to Frankie watching over her. She then awakens another time with Scrap looking after her, and then she tells Scrap her spinal cord is broken in two places and she's a quadriplegic. In the hallway, Frankie blames Scrap for Maggie's injuries for urging him to train her. Frankie tells Maggie he's going to get her out of Vegas into a better hospital for treatment, and he calls doctors all over the country, finding none that can improve Maggie's condition. We see a touching scene of Frankie cleaning and caring for Maggie like he's her nurse, in which she tearfully thanks him. 2 months later, they finally drive back to LA via ambulance, which Maggie reminds Frankie of their deal. Frankie puts Maggie in a top-notch rehab facility where they can properly care for her. In another scene after, Frankie is seen crying softly in his church. Scrap narrates that Maggie's family said they would visit while she waits for days by the window on them. Frankie waits with Maggie and tells her they could live together somewhere else. Maggie's family finally arrives in Walt Disney gear with a lawyer and notary. Maggie's mother tries to get Maggie to sign over her assets to her during the visit, but Maggie, seeing through her mother's greed and lack of remorse for her injury and fighting career, tells them all to take their fat, lazy, hillbilly asses back to Missouri, to never come back, or she will sell the house out from under them. So just to backtrack a tad, I don't think you saw it coming when she gets cheap shotted in the title fight on falls and has this tragic injury. I mean, I was just in utter shock. And then from when we cut to her waking up, man, just so rough. And then to hear it confirmed she's paralyzed. It changes the movie right there. You're immediately in a different film.
It's unlike any sports movie for me. I mean, maybe there's a few out there that you could find, but it's like she's rocking and rolling. She's doing well in this fight. I kind of thought when I going into this movie that maybe this was just her going to be her first real struggle to win a fight, or maybe she loses by decision, or, you know, something of that nature. I never
comes saw back
in a million years that it ends this way, that she falls on a stool and then, yeah, it's paralyzed. Like, that was, like you said, it's complete switches. It does a complete 180 becomes something else entirely.
And then every scene preceding is just devastating. And then you get glints of, you know, humanity and hope, but at the same time, you're stuck in this devastating situation. It's just so tough. And then I did feel, you know, some strength when she told her family off, though. That was a redeeming moment, but, you know, she's still stuck where she's at. We cut to a doctor looking at Maggie's leg and informing her that she might have to lose it. We get a short montage with Frankie, who returns to Maggie having lost her leg. She asks Frankie to please pull the plug on her and let her pass on, just like her father did for Axel. She's seen the world. She's had fans screaming her name. She's accomplished all she wanted to do. Frankie refuses, and he's devastated that she would ask. Next scene, Frankie gets a call in the middle of the night that Maggie bit her tongue in an attempted suicide to bleed to death. Frankie arrives at the hospital as they're stitching her up, only to get a call later that she ripped out the stitches and she had tried again as he's returned to the hospital. Frankie goes to meet with his priest, telling him of Maggie's situation and her request. The priest tells Frankie that he has attended Mass every day for 23 years, meaning he is carrying immense burdens and that he would be lost for good if he grants Maggie's wish. Don't know if I agree with that, but Frankie, we'll get into that. Frankie visits a sedated Maggie to deter her from attempting suicide again. further hurting Frankie as he cannot communicate with her. Frankie goes to the gym to get adrenaline for Maggie. Scrap walks in on him and tells him he visited Maggie. Frankie apologizes for blaming Scrap, and Scrap reassures Frankie that he's doing the right thing in granting Maggie's last wish, since Maggie was able to accomplish everything she set out to do. Frankie visits Maggie one last time in her room, telling her he's going to unplug her ventilator and then give her the shot of adrenaline. He kisses her one last time and tells her Mokushla means my darling, my blood. We see Scrap at the facility in the shadows as Frankie leaves, having administered the adrenaline. We then see Scrap at the hit pit waiting on Frankie, but he never shows up. The next morning, Danger returns, telling Scrap he was right. Anybody can lose one fight, and just a really, you know, redeeming scene. Scrap says Frankie never came back at all. No note and no trace of him. As Scrap narrates, we realize his narration has been a letter to Frankie's daughter that we see him writing in the office. As Scrap closes the letter, we see a distant roadside diner with what looks to be Frankie sitting at the counter, and we fade to black.
Oh, gut punch.
Right. Yeah, that the last 30 minutes are just brutal. So let's get into our top three favorite scenes of this film. You want to go back and forth here, rotisserie style?
Yeah, let's go for it. I'll go first. The narration describing boxing by Morgan Freeman. It's a very poetic way to discuss boxing. You know, boxing is an unnatural, you know, just everything, how he explains the movements of boxing, and just a very pretty picture for someone who may not watch a lot of boxing or not know a lot about boxing. It's a good setup.
Absolutely. Just listen to his voice alone. I love when Scrap knocks out Sherelle. That's one of my favorite scenes. It's one of those winning moments of the movie, you know, that you can really celebrate.
Yeah, for sure. That you talked about knocking the bully down. My second favorite on this list is when Frankie and the priest are discussing the sermon. You know, I almost wept, and you know, they talk about the Trinity, and just the priest's response to some of his, you know, he's obviously prodding and trying to get a rise out of the priest. It's just this great back and forth, to show kind of how Frankie is with people.
Absolutely. Some great quotes in that too. I love when Maggie, Hillary Swank's character, tells her mom and family to go to hell. They're in the hospital. That's one of the few redeeming moments, or one of the few, you know, moments of strength she could show at that point, you know, being the state that she was in. So I love that for her.
Yeah, That's a good one. That's my 3A, but my number three is the apology scene where Frankie apologizes to Scrap, and it's just, it's a powerful, it's emotional, and he's about to go do a very difficult thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love the scene of Frankie being Maggie's nurse. Just such a touching, heartbreaking scene. You see how much he cares for her, and he's going to be by her side no matter what.
I like in the notes that you added the when they make fun of Sherelle, because what's the quote that she uses? Is it, it's hard, I don't know, Sherelle. Most fights I see you laying on your back.
He's like, your last fight, I thought the canvas had titties.
No, because you're
on Danger's the floor all
just,
night.
Danger's yeah. Like, hey, look at me.
I'm Sherelle. And then he falls. Yeah, it's great. It's so funny.
It's a lighthearted moment for a very deep movie.
Yeah, you got to inject the humor in it.
Yes, you know? We just did some quotes, but let's dive into our favorite quotes. You go first.
I love it when Maggie says to Frankie in the hospital, "You're the meanest man I ever met. No wonder no one loves you." It's after she asked him what Mokushla means, and he's like, "Well, you didn't win, so I'm not going to tell you."
Yeah, God, geez. Yeah. Brutal. Uh-huh. I kind of touched on it, but when he's narrating and he just says boxing is an unnatural act, I'd like, of course, if Morgan Freeman says anything, it pretty much sounds good. I read about a software company that you can upload your eulogy into it, and they can play him doing your eulogy at your funeral.
That's so unbelievable.
I guess it's a money making machine.
Gosh, I don't know if I'd go that far, man. And then I like the whole fly there, drive back, how that comes around, even though it's, you know, in a tragic way.
It's good that she can be so lighthearted. I like in the apology scene when Scrap says, people die every day, Frankie, mopping floors, washing dishes. And you know what their last thought is? I never got my shot. Because of you, Maggie got her shot. If she dies today, you know what her last thought will be? You know, it's true. A lot of people don't take the risks in life that maybe they wish they would have taken or get the opportunity that they wish they would have had. And regardless of where her circumstances boil down to, they're very unfortunate. But she lived. You know, I bet those, you know, year or whatever, how long time passes, it's the best year of her life.
Absolutely. Let's get into the score in our composer. The great Clint Eastwood, little did you know, our listeners may not know this, he does his own music for his films, which is fascinating to me. So I wanted to find out more about that. You know, how did that start? So I listened to an interview with him on the DGA podcast about his film Richard Jewell with Scott Cooper. And he asked him, like, when did you get into composing your own music? And he basically said he's always loved music. He's studied it his entire life. As a young actor, he would play music around Hollywood. And to the point he started writing his own, you know, little compositions down. And once he started directing, he said, you know, I was compelled to use them. In his own words, it worked out pretty good, is what he said, which, you know, it did. And he hasn't done the music on his last two films, which, that, you know, probably can contribute to his age, but he loves creating and composing music in his free times. And what I love about his scores, you know, they're sparse with the piano or the guitar or whatever instrument he uses. It's sparsely used throughout, but it's always so beautiful and kind of sets the atmosphere and really haunts what's going on with the action. And it's often Clint Eastwood himself playing the piano or whatever the instruments are involved, and he sings as well. In Flags of Our Fathers, he sings to open that film. So just such a talented guy, and the music to this is so beautiful, you know, minimal, but just so beautiful. Just adds to the journey, the emotional ride it takes us on.
It's like, can you, right off the top of your head, name an elite actor, director, who also does the music for every film that they do?
You would have to cut out the actor part. I know a few writer directors who are heavily involved with the music, but
to do all not, three. Golly.
Yeah, not on this level. Yeah, I know.
And it definitely it's definitely an Eastwood movie. When we talk about what it adds to this, it's like the tone, it's very recognizable. And the score really contributes to whatever movie he does. Like, the score really contributes to it. And that fading away in the last scene with the narration and the little overture, like, it's very well done. I'm just blown away that he does all the different things within the movies that he takes part in.
It's just like, you've been in the industry this long as an actor and then developed into a director, and you're a legend in both regards. It's kind of like he hit that peak and he just, you know, continued to ride his peak through decades. Yeah. It's so great to behold.
We'll get into casting cut, where we discuss possibilities or maybe who we thought we could have casted instead. The opening one here's the biggest one, because who knows what the movie would turn out like. For Frankie Dunn, Morgan Freeman was originally approached for that role, but he wanted Scrap instead. And this was, of course, before Eastwood had signed on in any capacity. But if this would have happened, who would you have cast as Scrap?
It's hard to picture anyone else in that role, especially once someone like Morgan Freeman takes it, but Forrest Whitaker, I think I could see playing him.
Yeah, he's got the frame of like an old retired heavyweight, and he already has you know, with the eye component that they tie into this, he has that going on already. I'd like to see the twist, though, where it's Samuel L. Jackson. I know it would have been completely different because, you know, Samuel is very, you know, very specific on how he acts, but the dynamic between him and Eastwood would have, or I guess Eastwood would have been gone in this movie, so I had to go with someone else. But I also like, you know, Whitaker's a good one. I also like James Earl Jones for the narration piece.
Yeah, he's got a great voice. I think Whitaker has a great voice too, underrated voice as a narrator. Let's get into our issues with this movie, which won't be many.
No.
For me, it's once Maggie gets hurt in the third act, it just goes a little long on letting us see her suffer. And just as a result, just being in that dark, depressing part of the film a little too long. And I just didn't like the priest's advice to Frankie on euthanasia. I don't think that's accurate to what a priest would tell him, saying he'd be lost forever. And then just as a fan of boxing, the Blue Bear would have been disqualified long before she could have dealt that fatal blow to Maggie. I mean, if Roy Jones Jr., who was undefeated in his heyday, got his first loss for a DQ for basically doing what she did, punching a guy while he was down, I mean, it was instant DQ. She would have been DQ'd as well.
Yeah. What a, like, when the mom's like, well, you I heard you lost, even though it may not have been your fault. No, you wouldn't have lost. Like, I don't care if his back was turned, the whole world saw it. I don't know if they should have written that a little differently. I'm not necessarily a fan of how it ends, not in like regards to him pulling the plug. I just felt like, I felt like I was left without some closure. I don't really have an exact way to explain it, but there are stuff that wasn't revealed throughout their process, like her discussing being on magazines and all these different things. Maybe that's something I would have liked to have seen. I want to see what the mother's performance could have been like if we had a bigger name in that role, like a Kathy Bates, like a powerful woman to really drive home that, like, you know, basically the worst mother you've ever seen on screen type thing. like I think Kathy Bates could have nailed it, because if you ever, like, we, you know, talk about Misery, she could be that character.
One of the best older actresses working as well, Kathy Bates. Shout out to her. She's almost in that Meryl Streep territory for me as far as talent, because she's immensely talented.
Oh, yeah. I think she would have been a great mother. It's like we have back-to-back movies here where we have bad parents. You know, in Lord of the Rings, we had terrible parent trying to, you know, set his son on fire while he's still alive. And then we have this parent trying to steal all their money. Like,
right.
Looks. Greatest resume edition, where we throw out names from this film and we discuss, they had to list one film to put on their resume before they applied for some type of job. What film would they put on there? We'll go with some of the notables, but yet not the top build. Let's go with Pena. Is this Michael Pena's greatest resume edition?
That is tough. I hate the movie, so I don't want to put Crash, even though, so he wins Best Picture for this and Crash. He has a bigger role in Crash. He is good in Crash. Let's put,
I'm going with The Martian. With The Martian. It gets nominated. Damon possibly could have won Best Actor had it not been Leo's year, essentially.
Yeah.
And Pena really adds to that movie. Like, it's probably his largest role within a, like, Best Picture nominee.
I think you're right. That would be his meatiest role. Yeah. I love that movie. He's so good.
Yeah.
Let's do Anthony Mackie. I think we can both agree. Probably the Hurt Locker for him. You know, it wins Best Picture. He has a significant, I mean, he's essentially the second leading man in that to Jeremy Renner, significant screen time. And he does a great job. They really butt heads very well in that movie. And he parlayed that into where he's at now within the MCU. And yeah, he out of, you know, an ensemble star-studded MCU, he really does stand out, which to me is amazing. Like, if you can stand out with all that talent, you know, you don't exactly get a ton of screen time necessarily each film, but he always makes the most of it.
Yeah, Hurt Locker all the way. What a great movie. I mean, if we're talking just bringing in money, of course he's going to get paid bank for the MCU. But Hurt Locker is it's an all-timer on a very talk about a low budget.
We'll talk about it in a few pods.
Yeah, we'll get to it. Jay Baruchel, How to Train Your Dragon.
Yeah, probably. Or she's out of my league. No, I'll put this just because he actually does have some decent screen time in this. He's excellent, you know, such an empathetic character. You really root for him, and this one Best Picture. And I think people, when they look at Jay Baruchel, they see the comedies, but they will remember you were in Million Dollar Baby too. Oh my God. Yeah, I think he has that recognizability.
I agree. Let's get into some of the ones with more notable careers. Let's start with our leading lady, Hilary Swank.
Well, she won for Boys Don't Cry in this, so you would think it'd be one of those two. I'm going to pick Freedom Riders just because I love her in that movie. Like, that's my personal favorite performance of hers. But, you know, she's obviously...
Yeah, that's a good one. You're an English teacher. Why wouldn't that be it?
Yeah.
It's a movie that I think people probably need to watch right now in regards to just showing love to anyone, no matter what their background is.
Has a very strong message in it as well that we can all, you know, take note. What about you?
I go Million Dollar Baby, Best Picture and Best Actress the same year. You know, she doesn't have that with Boys Don't Cry. So, yeah, I go with this one. Morgan Freeman. I'm like you. I'm going to use some personal bias here in regards to what my favorite is, and I'm going to go Shawshank. I think, for me, it's a top five movie of all time. I just love it that much and enjoy it that much. And I can't imagine that movie. I mean, if you turn that in, people are going to go, wow, yeah, Shawshank. I mean, IMDb, as far as viewers go, it's the number one movie of all time. And depending on what you're, you know, it's a movie that's going to stand the test of time, I think.
It has for me. I'll just do Million Dollar Baby to be different, and because he won his Oscar for it. But, man, performance-wise, Shawshank, yes, is his best work. If you haven't seen that movie, listeners, watch it immediately. That's a travesty if you haven't.
Yeah, you're missing out. Clint Eastwood. Clint Eastwood, man, this one, we have a lot of films in this repertoire of his. Where are you headed?
I'm going to do this one because it gave him his second win for both Best Picture as a producer and then Best Director, you know, in that elite pantheon of directors who, you know, have done that. Not very many. You know, Francis Ford, Coppola, Oliver Stone, and Spielberg, I mentioned, are some of the few. So, you know, it's got to be this film just for cementing his legacy.
I'm going to do a 180 here. I'm going with Million Dollar Baby as well. I think when you really reflect on his career, this is just a masterpiece and something just a little extra icing on the cake for it was already a brilliant career. And then after, what's incredible is 16 years later, we're still talking about the guy and movies he's pumping out.
The Academy does love him, but for good reason, you know.
Yeah.
Let's get into the competition.
Oh, yeah.
Always exciting for us. I'm going to lead us off with a film that I adore and I love in every sense of the word, The Aviator. Martin Scorsese's The Aviator, Leonardo DiCaprio playing the title role of Howard Hughes. It's a biopic about the beginning of Howard Hughes's life as a movie man into his life as an aviator, as a aviation giant, as a tycoon in that industry. And unfortunately, diving into the aspects of his life that brought him, his personal life that brought him down, his obsessive compulsive disorder being number one. it worsened as he grew older. And Leo Scorsese together in this film, their second film together, Leo gives one of his best performances, one of my favorite performances of his. He's just fantastic in every sense of the word, steals every scene. It has that ensemble cast with John C. Reilly, who we've talked about, the great Kate Blanchett won an Oscar for this film, playing Katharine Hepburn. It has many real life people who were from that era, who then, you know, they have actors play them and they all do a fantastic job. Alec Baldwin, Alan Alda included. So it's just a Scorsese masterpiece with some of Leo's best work. And it's a biopic about a true pioneer for airplanes in this country. And then someone who, kind of like John Nash, had some very terrible ailments, mental illnesses that brought him down ultimately, but lived a fascinating life. And it's brought to screen vividly and beautifully by Scorsese and Leo.
It is a great movie. And if you have not seen it, and if you're a fan of any Scorsese or a fan of Leonardo DiCaprio, it's definitely something you need to add to your watch list this summer. The next film for our competition is Finding Neverland, a very interesting nomination. I want to start off, I do enjoy this movie, but throughout what I'm about to say, it may come off that it's not one of my favorites. But, you know, I own this movie, and I've watched it at least four or five times. You know, Finding Neverland is a Mark Foster film. So we're talking about movies like Monsters Ball, Stranger Than Fiction, World War Z, and then Christopher Robin, which there's a lot of similarities if you've seen that movie and this movie as far as tone and how they go through the story. So it stars Johnny Depp and Kate Winslet. So we've got two pretty famous leads there. I would go out and say this is Johnny Depp's best performance as an actor, where he actually plays a normal character. And like, I'm talking, you know, he's not playing, he's not playing Sweeney Todd. He's not playing Jack Sparrow. He's not playing like the even Secret Window, where he's, you know,
Black Mass doesn't count here.
Yeah. Like, you know, just take out all of his very unique roles he does and playing a real man. And it's really good. And then, you know, Winslet's always great on screen in the film. It centers around J.M. Barrie, you know, the man who gave us Peter Pan. And Barrie meets this widow at one of his shows. Her name's Sylvia. And this is the character played by Winslet. The two of them have this very deep but ultimately platonic friendship. And they connect so well that people begin to think he's having an affair on his wife. But, you know, that never takes place. He legitimately loves Sylvia as a person, as a friend. And he grows to bond with her children, almost like an uncle or a fill-in dad, since their dad was taken from them. You know, in the film, she becomes ill from some unnamed illness that we don't get to know about. But he brings life and joy into, you know, her last days and the family. You know, it's this really feel-good story, but it has this fantasy scenes in it when he's pretend playing with the children. It creates this fantastic stories around him, and you get to see where he got his motivation for Peter Pan. Takes place, you know, the scenes were in Kensington Gardens, which after being there this summer, it's just a beautiful landscape. It's a film worth watching. If you're someone who enjoys period pieces or like biopics, give it a watch. It's fun, it's sad, it's inspirational all at the same time. All of that said, it's not a movie that's where you, it's not like this movie in regards to at the end you going, oh my gosh, that's an incredible movie. Like, it's not there, but it's still a movie I would consider when they broadened the category to include more movies. It definitely would have been included, but I'm not sure it's in the five.
Movie I have not seen, actually. Shocker.
Hey, like I said, I've got it. I can give you the DVD.
All right. I'll have to watch it. Next film that was nominated was Ray, the Taylor Hackford, Ray Charles biopic with Jamie Foxx in the title role. He did win Best Actor for this film, which I disagree with. I'll just say I feel like Leo got robbed in this, but, you know, neither here nor there. Ray is a very good biopic about Ray Charles's life. You know, a very talented blind pianist who made some brilliant, beautiful music, and who, you know, like many musicians and celebrities, succumbed to drug addiction, but overcame that and many other obstacles, and, you know, including being blind and just an award-winning musician who lived a great life and made a lot of music that people really admired in a tough time in this country. And Jamie Foxx is really good in this movie. I just, you know, didn't think it. He deserved Best Actor over Leo once again. But I will say Ray is a very well-made biopic. I can see why it was nominated.
Yeah. You know, we'll get into later what we thought may have been a better performance by him.
Tell us about our favorite.
Oh, yeah. Zach and I love this movie all the way back to probably college. Sideways. So it's directed by Alexander Payne, who also gave us a movie we've discussed on this pod about Schmidt. He did The Descendants. He did Nebraska. He also takes part in writing this film. You know, this movie is an adaptation of the book with the same name, and it stars one of my favorites, Paul Giamatti. It's got Thomas Hayden Church, Virginia Madsen, and Sandra Oh, and it's a gem. Like, Giamatti and Church, they're best friends, Miles and Jack, and they go on this tour of wine country. It's kind of like a two-man bachelor's trip because Jack's going to get married. And it's a comedy, it's a drama, it's a that buddy road trip. The comedy, it's perfect. Like, you and I still quote some of the movie today. The drama is perfect because Miles, played by Giamatti, he's recovering from his divorce, and he's this wine aficionado slash snob writing this about, you know, 10,000-page novel, and he's basically the most miserable character you're ever going to meet. He actually finds love on the trip while Church, he's just so absolutely self-absorbed, and he's like this B-list soap actor who's on this hunt to just basically cheat the entire time while on his bachelor trip. And it's top-notch acting by both the men in it. It's a travesty that Giamatti got snubbed because he's so great weird. In it. So is Church. Yeah, I mean, that argument can be made for him.
He did get nominated, though.
I mean, an argument made for him to, like, win almost.
Oh, yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, because he brings the movie around full circle. I do really want to see a prequel where we see them, like, meeting and developing a friendship. Like, I'm first to stand in line by a ticket. If you want a great laugh in a movie that just covers, checks all the little boxes of emotions, go watch this. It's one of Paul Giamatti's finest.
Absolutely. A movie I adore from a writer-director combo who I adore in Alexander Payne. He pumps out just some great family dramas that always have enough comedy in them. Yeah, I love it. So let's get into our snubs. Another exciting time for us. Do you want to lead us off? Yes, sir. Why don't you lead us off here?
All right, you know, there's several to choose from. I'm going to start off with just, you know, this reoccurring theme of Charlie Kaufman movies showing up, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. It's a very unique movie. It's a very wild movie. I don't want to get too much in the plot because it's all over the place, but this is a very different Jim Carrey role. Like, for our fans out there, if you enjoy watching Jim Carrey, you need to watch this because it's a very – it's a very different version of him, but he's really good in it. It's got Kate Winslet. You know, she doubled up this year as far as doing some pretty strong roles. It's so outside the box. It will keep you, you'll have to really be on your toes to follow along. But if you really want to see Jim Carrey in this whole other version of himself with this interwoven plot, like, you know, it got a writing nom. It's not the best movie of this year, but I think it's a movie worth at least watching, and I believe you can find it on HBO Max.
Indeed. Next snub is Collateral, Michael Mann's maybe second best film. I still need to watch The Insider. I'll get on that. This film was another Jamie Foxx Oscar-nominated performance for Best Supporting, co-starring with Tom Cruise in what I would consider maybe Tom Cruise's best role of his career. Tom Cruise plays a hitman, and he kidnaps Jamie Foxx, who is a taxi cab driver in L.A., and has him drive him around while he performs his hits during the night on his contract. It's a Michael Mann film. What more can I say? Think of Heat and ratchet up the tension by 10 because you're working in a, you know, only a time frame of a night. So it's excellent. It's, you know, cutting edge LA, you know, action, hardwire thriller story. It has everything you want. Great performances, a fantastic ending as well. You know, I don't want to spoil too much for it, but if you're a fan of Michael Mann, Tom Cruise, Jamie Foxx, and you'll have to remind me, Mark Ruffalo, right, is in this.
Yeah, he's the
detective. And let me tell you, if you want to see Mark Ruffalo in a light you've never seen him in, watch it. He's excellent as well. Collateral.
And I want to take back after rewatching it, it's number two. Inside is three. It's number two. Heat obviously won, but it's number two. The next snub I'm going to throw out. And not necessarily, depending on who you ask, they would say this critically acclaimed, but it's a very controversial film for some people. The Passion of the Christ. Man, I know for several million Christians, the greatest story ever told, it used to be the witnessing tool that showed the depiction and the story of Jesus Christ. But wow, this film. Here's the thing. Whoever you are out there, wherever you stand on your faith, this is an excellent film. For me, it has this deep, impactful connection to my faith. But, you know, maybe you're someone out there who doesn't believe in any of this. But here's the thing. You know, great films about storytelling. I think most people would at least agree that the Bible is great storytelling. You may have your thoughts on whether or not you believe that it's fact or you think that it's all false or it's all a farce. Whatever you may believe, Christ preaches a message that a lot of people should take to heart nowadays about love and loving your brother and loving those around you. And this is a tale about his last days on earth. And it's gripping and it's heart-wrenching and it's a violent depiction of what he went through and the toll on his body. It's shot beautifully. The music is breathtaking. Jim Caviezel, like, he had to learn Latin and reconstructed Aramaic just to do the role. Two of the most difficult languages you could possibly try to do. It's shot by Caleb Deschanel, who, along with this film, you know, he has 6 Academy Award nominations for cinematography, and it's on full display in the movie. It's directed by Mel Gibson, and I know Mel, several personal issues, including some anti-Semitic, you know, feelings that probably stem, you know, originally in this movie on somehow the Jewish community is portrayed, but you know, this and Hacksaw Ridge are breathtaking. Like, Christian, Muslim, Jewish, agnostic, give this film a chance solely based on it being a film. And it puts you, you know, your beliefs aside and just follow along and watch how great it is to look at from a visual standpoint.
The best actor, director, not named Clint Eastwood, is Mel Gibson. I firmly believe in that.
Yeah. I mean, like, why, and you know, you and I are big about putting aside how people are just solely as an artist. Like, yeah.
It's a film I watched in theater and then I watched once on DVD and I've never watched it again, but everything you said, it stuck with me. And yeah, if you know that story, it's the perfect way to show it in cinematic form. My next film is Closer, Mike Nichols' film, may rest in peace, the classic director of The Graduate, the Dustin Hoffman film, way back in 67. So he directs that. He does Charlie Wilson's War is his last film, which you and I adore. And he does Closer this year. Closer is a very interesting film. It's got Jude Law, it's got Clive Owen, it's got Julia Roberts, and it's got Natalie Portman. Clive Owen and Natalie Portman were nominated in the best supporting categories for this film, and it's essentially a love quadrangle between all four of their characters. Think Unfaithful, but even more messed up without murder going on. No murder, but very messed up relationship stuff. Brilliant performances, great acting by all parties involved. As I said, two were nominated, and it's a good watch. It's one of those relationship dramas, juicy relationship dramas that you can really get into.
Yeah, and I still can't believe I watched that with my mother.
Oh God, no. Yeah, like me watching Sideways in theater with my mom, and when, yeah, you know, confronts Giamatti naked. That was fun.
yeah, right. The next one I have is Hotel Rwanda, and the first time I ever watched this was in our guy, Frank Scheid's Class, and it's a film that shows a glimpse of the Rwandan genocide from 1994, and it stars an actor in Don Cheadle, who we will discuss in our next pod as well. You know, he got an Oscar nomination for this, and it also has another, and the award goes to person, the alum that we love in Joaquin Phoenix. It's got Nick Nolte. They're both, all three are great in their roles. It's a truly sad movie, just like this film. You know, a terrible situation for what that country went through. There's a, you know, there's a lot of, you know, what we are dealing with in our country today that's still on display as far as some of the cultural insensitivity that goes on. You know, the conflict between the Hutu and the Tutsi in this, it's deeply disturbing. And Cheadle, he plays this general manager of an elite hotel, and he essentially is the you know, the Schindler in this story of saving these people. And it's a great watch, and it's, but it's mostly carried by Cheadle. But like I said, it's got Joaquin in it, and it's a good movie. It's a very good movie.
Never seen Joaquin in a bad role, so I believe it. My next and last snub is Friday Night Lights, Peter Berg's best film by far, a great true story of the Odessa, Texas Permian Panthers, the high school there. And if you know anything about high school football in Texas, it's like a religion. It shuts down entire towns on Friday nights. Everyone just goes to the game. And Billy Bob Thornton plays the head coach in this town. You know, as our people from Arkansas, I think Luke's with, well, you're not from Arkansas, but, you know, indoctrinated anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I claim Arkansas. So,
so we adore Billy Bob Thornton and his talent. You know, I love Billy Bob Thornton, and I think he's one of the better actors there is. So he's top notch in this. You have a kind of an ensemble cast as well of younger actors who went on to get cast in some bigger things and some bigger roles. And it's a true story. If you like high school football, if you like football, if you like sports movies, this is a fantastic movie with a classic heartbreaking sports ending. And I love it. I love the music in it. There's a lot of things about this movie to like, so check it out if you haven't seen it, Friday Night Lights.
Yeah, and I know a lot of people who have watched the TV series and not watched the movie, and I'm like, you got to go back and watch the movie. It's a good one.
Nuts.
My last one is Kill Bill Volume 2, just like our last pod, another Tarantino snub. It's even better than the first one. I mean, the bride finally gets to her where she wanted to go in terms of resolution. You know, like I said last time, you have to understand what Tarantino is going for in this film, in both of them. For me, I think it's a top five film, you know, of his all time. It's an excellent movie that really does a great job of playing homage to all those, you know, different types of movies that he tries to put on display here from different eras. And you know, it's rough that back-to-back years he gets left off, but you know, so is the nature of the business.
You said you got it top five of his.
Yeah, I think.
Yeah, I'd probably have it in my five spot as well.
It's, you know, he's got so many that are great.
Yeah,
but I think this one's it's pretty well done.
I'd agree with that. We'll talk more Tarantino and Parasite pod.
Yeah, he'll come up again. You know, for sure. A
couple times actually.
Yeah,
with Inglourious Basterds. It's just his lack of luck though in that area is kind of astounding. But
you know, okay, I don't think he really even cares though. I think he's just like
He's 1-2 for writing, so yeah. You know, he's, or maybe 3 for writing actually. I think he's 1-3. So either way, let's get to our five though, Lucas. Let's present our five best picture picks for this Academy Awards season. And just looking at our lists here, we don't reveal these till the end. We're pretty similar. We did 4 out of the 5, so that's pretty good. Our 4 that we have: Sideways, Million Dollar Baby, The Aviator, and Collateral. My 5th spot is Ray. What is your 5th spot?
I just have to go with Passion of the Christ. I am maybe a little biased there, but just how it's shot and the language that they had to incorporate into it and keep that authentic. I think it's a marvelous film. I think a lot of what it got hit with in the terms of negativity had to do with maybe personal beliefs. And, you know, sometimes that will kill you as far as critical acclaim goes. But Passion of the Christ for me. Who deserved the award? We're about to go into, and our award goes to, would you like to go first, sir? Or would you like me to throw mine out there?
You go ahead, since I'm, you know, straying from the consensus this time.
So this was the hardest one for me thus far. And I've always felt this was, in fact, Leonardo DiCaprio's first big snub. And I think Aviator is a classic. And he only gets better as an actor. So that just speaks to how great that movie is. But yeah, I'm going to follow the Academy. I choose Million Dollar Baby. As devastating as it is, it's fantastic. Our three main performances are perfect. The directing, the story, just everything about it was truly amazing. And it's hard to look past all the accolades that it received and how great it was on rewatch. And, you know, not think, yeah, this really was probably the best film of the year. It was tough, but Million Dollar Baby.
Not upset with that decision by you. My pick is The Aviator, and I have a couple reasons why, and I'll just break that down. I choose The Aviator, one, to give Martin Scorsese his first Best Picture win and Best Director win in my alternate Academy Awards. And, you know, I'm sorry to take number two away from Clint with that, but I just view The Aviator as one of the best biopics ever done. I really think it's a perfect film in every sense of the word, from the ensemble cast with perfect performances, even to the, you know, the minor supporting roles you see in the film. They're all spot on. How they shot it, the great Robert Richardson, the cinematographer, you know, just basically taking you through the time period and showing you what colors were around and then converting that to film, like, that's astounding in itself. And he did win an Oscar for this. And, you know, I love Scorsese, and I just feel like Leo, yes, he was robbed for this film, but I feel like The Aviator is essentially a tale of the American dream and what it can do to you in a lot of ways, despite being incredibly gifted and being able to do a lot of good things. You know, America chews up and spits out a lot of people, and it did that to someone as brilliant as Howard Hughes, who had that much money. And I just feel like they tell that story in a perfect way. I'm with you. Like I said, Million Dollar Baby has that emotional impact of some of the best films ever made that stays with you. And I'm not upset that it won and that Clint has two Oscars. It's just, if it was up to me, I would have awarded Marty his first with this film, unlike you doing Gangs of New York for his first. Because we got to keep track of that.
I mean, yeah, from Gangs of New York, Catch Me If You Can, Aviator, as far as Leo goes, and then into Blood Diamond and The Departed, like, he just starts ripping them off. And this was like, you can't even say it's peak Leo because he has such a great career, but it is great Leo for sure. Any final words on Million Dollar Baby?
If you haven't seen the film, please watch it. You won't regret it. Heartbreaking, but a brilliant, brilliant Clint Eastwood movie.
Agreed. You can find it on HBO Max along with other streaming services. Next time, we'll be breaking down the 78th Academy Award winner for Best Picture, Crash. You don't want to miss it. I'm Luke Shoemaker.
And I'm Zach King.
And you just listened to, and the award goes to. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.